Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's fun and understandable. I'm John Wells along with my co-host Lynn Ware Peake. We have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest is Brad Stone, author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos, and The Age of Amazon. Amazon.com started off delivering books through the mail, but its visionary founder, Jeff Bezos, wasn't content with being a bookseller. He wanted Amazon to become the everything store, offering limitless selection, seductive convenience, and disruptively low prices. To do so, he developed a corporate culture of relentless ambition and secrecy that has not been cracked until now. Stone enjoyed unprecedented access to current and former Amazon employees and Bezos family members, giving readers the first in-depth fly-on-the-wall account of life at Amazon. We look forward to our conversation with Brad.
And good morning. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is Professor Mike Dunn, Director of Laser Fusion Energy at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. Dunn joined the lab in 2010. His role includes leadership of the Laser Inertial Fusion Energy Project, which is designed to build from National Ignition Facility to deliver electrical power to the U.S. at the gigawatt plant scale. Now, if that all sounds confusing, it may be. But remember cold fusion? Whatever happened to cold fusion? That's all part of the conversation. We'll look forward to talking with Mike Dunn. These two guests, plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hola, soy Jorge, uno de los anfitriones de cada domingo. Escuche cada domingo en KPCW 91.9 FM, todos los domingos en las tardes de las 7 a las 10 p.m. Tenemos música, información de la comunidad y perdidos y encontrados. Por favor, denle like o me gusta a la página Facebook de cada domingo. Cada domingo, solo en Park City, solo KPCW. Hi, I'm Jorge, one of the hosts for KPCW's Cada Domingo. You can hear Cada Domingo every Sunday evening on KPCW 91.9 FM from 7 to 10 p.m., where you can hear music, community information, and lost and founds. Please like the KPCW Cada Domingo Facebook page. Cada Domingo, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Brad Stone, author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos, and The Age of Amazon. Compared to tech's other elite innovators, Jobs, Gates, Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos is a private man, but he stands out for a singular laser-like focus on the customer, providing limitless selection, convenience, low prices, quick shipment. He transformed retail in the same way Henry Ford revolutionized manufacturing. Brad's book is the biography of the company that placed one of the first and largest bets on the internet and forever changed the way we shop and read. Brad Stone, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Jeff, I have to, Brad, I have to tell you that we only received one book. We usually get two. So we had to share it, and I had to get it back to Lynn yesterday morning. And what I ended up doing was I was going to skim the book. What I ended up doing was I stayed up till like 2:30 in the morning reading it. I couldn't put it down.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a very good book. Amazon was founded in 95, but didn't show a quarterly profit until 2002. I think they actually, according to your book, lost $1 billion in 2000. And this time period, of course, straddles the dot-com meltdown. This perseverance and laser-like focus by Bezos that he was building something special and it was going to happen, where did this come from?
You know, it was in a lot of ways, it was a function of the time. You know, it wasn't just the dot-com bust, but it was the boom. So, you know, this is the late 90s. I don't think he meant to run, you know, originally such a profligate business and to raise so much, you know, debt and cash in the stock market. But it was the opportunity. You know, it was that moment where the world kind of opened up to the possibilities of the internet. You know, it's funny because we're talking on the day when Twitter is going public and some of the same optimism is in the air and the stock price is in the stratosphere right now. And, you know, that was the same thing then. And Bezos, who, you know, started in books, but all along really, you know, saw the larger opportunity for online retail and saw that there was a kind of land grab going on the internet for you know, for brands to establish foundations. He just went for it, and it was an expensive proposition, but you know, the markets allowed him to do it. He advertised heavily, and you know, he spent a lot of money and he lost a lot of money. And then it wasn't until 2000-2001 when the mood just kind of, you know, not even subtly but dramatically shifted, and suddenly everybody wanted to see a profit, and you know, that they had to kind of get their house in order. And as you said, you know, it's one of the things that kind of distinguishes him. He was able to turn the business around and cut back and focus it and make it profitable.
And Bezos was a Sam Walton disciple, a.k.a. Walmart. He read Made in America, Push Frugality, Bias for Action, which was really, you know, Walmart's mantra. And he pushed that into the culture of Amazon. Did he envision from the beginning that he was building a Walmart.com when he launched Amazon?
Well, I think he picked up all, you know, things from a lot of different places. And you're right, he read the Walton autobiography, and he transplanted some of the DNA. And it wasn't just that. He also hired from Walmart in the early years. I don't think he was I think he probably viewed e-commerce as quite different from physical commerce. But he also knew that kind of Walmart was the, you know, this was a completely untested notion that you could build a large retailer online and you could develop distribution that shift not to stores, but to people's homes. I mean, no one had ever done it at that scale before. And the closest corollary that he had in some ways was Walmart, because here was a, you know, a massive retailer with sophisticated IT systems and pretty sophisticated distribution. Now it turned out that Walmart wasn't half as sophisticated in a lot of ways as Amazon needed to be. And some of the transplanted, you know, folks that he brought over, you know, ended up not staying very long because it really was a completely unique challenge. So, it, you know, in some ways, Walmart was helpful, certainly culturally, but in other ways, it kind of just wasn't relevant to what he was building.
Mm. Brad, I know that it's difficult to write a book about Amazon without talking about Jeff Bezos, or without making it about Jeff Bezos, and probably difficult to do the opposite. But I'm wondering, you know, for people who are curious about this book, you know, where does the discussion of Jeff Bezos, this iconic leader, you know, leave off? And when is it really about Amazon.com?
That's a great question, because I really had set off to do a story of the company. And I always knew that Bezos would be kind of the central character. But as I pursued the research and talked to hundreds of people, current and former employees and partners and rivals and then the investors, it just became really difficult to tease the two apart. I mean, every major decision at Amazon is driven by its founder. You know, he's cut from the same mold as a Steve Jobs or a Larry Page. You know, these are founder-driven companies where no one cares more than the creator, and he's deeply involved in every major decision. So, and also, I think, you know, what we continue to see today is a company that is really almost relentless in its, you know, in its expansion and in the ways that it innovates, and sometimes in the way that it can kind of brutally undercut, you know, competitors and even some of its partners. And that's Bezos too. You know, you have to really understand what's driving this company. You have to understand its CEO. So I kind of found the two to be inseparable. Uh-huh. And while it's still primarily, I think, a portrait of the company, you know, I also tried to explore, you know, Bezos' upbringing and kind of, you know, the ingredients that went into, you know, this remarkable man.
Right. Well, let's go into that, his upbringing a little bit. I mean, as you're using some of these adjectives to describe the company, like relentless, you know, you're also describing him, of course. And he seems to be this character that, I mean, I found so many contradictory, again, adjectives, loved and feared, warm yet acerbic, you know, expansive yet secretive. So let's set the stage for who is Jeff Bezos. Maybe just a quick little history.
Sure. Well, I opened the book with this. We have this remarkable account of what he was like as a sixth grader, because there was actually an author in Houston, Texas, who was writing about gifted education. And one of the chapters focuses on the school that Bezos is attending. And he is represented, depicted in one of the chapters under a pseudonym named Tim. And so we have this picture of, you know, this incredibly gifted, intelligent young man who is in this remarkable program for gifted youngsters, who's taking a blaze of classes, and who's very immersed in the computer school has. So clearly, like, a gifted individual with really broad potential at a very early age. Number of mentors, his grandfather, was in government service and interested in science, mentored him, and his dad, really, technically, his stepdad, was a Cuban immigrant who, bootstrapped his way out of poverty and was an executive at Exxon, and his mom, who had Jeff when she was 17, was, very deeply involved, inspiring figure for Jeff and his friends. And then there's one other element, to the story, which I kind of uncovered, which is I went and I found his biological father. His parents had been married only briefly when Bezos was young, and it's interesting. It seems like in so many of these cases, like a Steve Jobs or a Barack Obama, we have these similar situations.
Mm-hmm.
To make a long story short, I found his biological father running on a bike shop outside of Phoenix, and he hadn't even known what had become of his biological son.
Oh.
So that was an extremely interesting element to the story as well.
Oh, no kidding. And I just want to briefly point out, and this, I guess, gives credibility to your own investigative practices as an author and a writer, some pretty amazing things to even uncover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, well, it was unexpected on my part because I just, assumed that this man was off somewhere quietly, watching what his progeny had achieved. And
yeah.
It turned out because the families had really gone their separate ways. He didn't have any idea. He had wondered his whole life what had happened to the child that he had fathered when he was a teenager, but he had never known. And it was really a wound in his life. And so, I don't know. I really couldn't say whether that explains anything about Bezos or about Amazon, but it is one of these, and we're now way outside my core competency, but when you look at the public figures, the driven, people that have changed our world, we mentioned a few, but Bill Clinton and, the Lance Armstrong story is similar. Like, there's always an element.
Jobs, Ellison.
Exactly. Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison. And I don't know what to make of that, but I do think maybe, there's some aspect to, they're kind of relentless need to prove oneself.
And survive.
Yeah, yeah.
There were a number of examples in your book of, in this quest and this focus for the customer, how he would strong-arm suppliers, vendors, potential suitors, or companies that they may want to purchase. And I don't want to go through all those details, but I just want to go through one quickly because I want to talk about a contradiction in Jeff Bezos' psyche. The Internet Diaper Company, a couple of women in New Jersey, they build a $300 million Internet Diaper Company. I think it's Quidsy is the name of the company.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And Jeff decides that he wants them to be a part of Amazon and talks to them. They basically say, no, they want to be independent. And so he decides to bring them to the point of desperation by undercutting their pricing so much that he purposely loses $100 million in the first year trying to wipe them out. And then he kind of swings in and buys them for a song. And this has happened several times, and the examples in your book are fascinating. What I want to ask you is he sits down with eBay CEO John Donahue, and he says that business is not a zero-sum game. Basically, transactions, relationships are win-win. You don't have one winner and one loser. This contradiction is very big. What's to make of this?
I would say he's you're right. It's interesting. eBay was a company that, in a lot of ways, had outpaced Amazon early on and gotten to the concept of the everything store, before Amazon did, and then had its own kind of troubles as it matured. But it was a peer in many respects, and it really had a distinguished or different model. Auctions, and it was kind of a different animal.
But why would he say that? Why would he go out and try to wipe these companies out and then come in and say
But then let's look at diapers.com. So diapers.com was really, kind of trying to out-Amazon Amazon. It's not an eBay sitting over in another yard. It grows up in Amazon's backyard. it's selling a commodity. There's nothing special or exclusive about a package of diapers. And it's using Amazon's own playbook, which is, you know, great customer experience, discounted shipping, very low margins, rapid growth. And what we've seen of those of those kinds of companies is that, you know, Amazon doesn't want a kind of brand growing up in its own backyard with the same values and customer proposition that it has. And when that's happened, he's moved pretty ruthlessly to undercut them or to stamp out, you know, because I would say it's probably more of a threat to his franchise. But in the same way, he didn't want Zappos, you know, a very flexible brand with a missionary founder, Tony Hsieh, you know, trying to be kind of the apparel Amazon. And he used some of the same tactics. Now, eBay is a very different animal, you know, with auctions, with you know, PayPal, some of the other franchises that it has. So I think he's probably, you know, eBay was, let's put it this way, at the point that they had that meeting, Jeff Bezos and the new CEO, John Donahoe, I don't think eBay was much of a threat to Amazon.
Okay. That's all very interesting. And it just makes me wonder at what point, you know, at what point Bezos wants to stop, you know, expanding or acquiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. It's funny, as a journalist covering Amazon, I get about two to three press releases almost a day with new Amazon services. So a new Kindle Fire tablet, or something new they're doing with authors, or a new aspect of the grocery business which they're expanding, or apparel,
yeah,
categories like art, or international efforts. They're expanding kind of blob-like in every direction. And where does it stop? I don't think it does. I mean, I think he's created a corporate culture of, you know, of growth and expansion and big ideas. And, you know, if you're asking kind of what the vision is, I think there's no end. I mean, I call the book The Everything Store because, you know, that's the goal. They want to sell everything to everyone in all countries, and they want to reach the scale of Walmart. And, you know, they've got a long way to go. Amazon, you know, is probably making $75 billion this year. Walmart's probably making close to $400 billion. So there's a lot of countries, there's a lot of product categories, a long way to go, and I think the vision is pretty ambitious.
Yeah. Our guest is Brad Stone. He's the author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. And Brad, tremendous buzz about your book. You spent 2 years of your life writing this thing. You talked to 300 people. You were given access to many top executives at Amazon. And I just want to ask the question why you weren't able to talk to Bezos himself.
Right. And also, I'll bring it up because maybe some of your listeners heard it and heard about this in the last few days, which is they haven't really loved the book. And I got a little bit of a blistering review from Jeff's wife the other day on Amazon. It was a 1-star review saying that she thought I brought a kind of bias to the depiction of the company. And I bring that up because, of course, I wasn't happy to see it. But because, you know, it sort of says something about the character of the company, which is, you know, they're secretive. They're very mission driven. You know, they want the world to know that they're extremely customer focused. And there's not a lot of room, you know, or they don't really see a lot of need, or perhaps they're trying to strategically avoid any kind of deeper insight into what's, you know, driving the company or why certain decisions were made that may not look too flattering when exposed to the light of day. And I never really expected Bezos to give me a Steve Jobs like treatment as he did with his biographer Walter Isaacson at the end of his life. The circumstances are a lot different, and Bezos still has a long way to go and a lot to achieve. So he was supportive. He told me he was rooting for me, and not sure, you know, how authentic that was, but he did open some doors and approve some interviews. But in the end, I think they're probably, you know, not crazy about it because, you know, it's a tough market they're in. They fight hard, and you know, the culture is uncomfortable for a lot of their workers. But the culture is also what drives them to success.
Yeah,
yeah. And we were going to talk about McKinsey's 1-star review that she came out with on Monday. What has been the backlash since then?
Well, it's been a fun week. There hasn't been much
a backlash. There's, you know, I think it probably, you know, drew a lot of attention to the book, you know, because, of course, conflict drives attention. You know, I, you know, no author likes to see a one-star review, but at the same time, I was a little proud of it, you know, that there was nothing significant that they were pointing to, you know, in terms of errors or in terms of bias. And, you know, and I wrote a response on the Business Week website, you know, acknowledging that all authors in some respects are guilty of bias. You know, our bias is towards moments of tension that reveal character. And that's kind of what I set out to do, explore the character of Amazon. And, you know, I think she was complaining a little bit that I gave short thrift to the many employees of Amazon who, you know, loved the experience and sent them notes of gratitude. And, you know, perhaps I did. I thought, you know, in the end, it was a balanced account. And you know, I talked to a lot of people who felt that their years at Amazon were the most productive in their careers. And I think that definitely comes out in the book.
Also, 20 years ago, I mean, if any of us were attending a meeting with three or four other people, and someone came and interviewed all of us today and asked for the recollections of that meeting, there'd be a lot of differences.
You might get some different versions, but I have to say at the same time, people's meetings with Jeff Bezos tend to be memorable. So I've been doing this for a long time, and you know, I think the key is the legwork. You know, and I spent years on this and hundreds of interviews. And the overall feedback has been, I think, you know, pretty great. I've heard from a lot of folks who have worked at Amazon, you know, who said, kind of finally, you know, that now my dad understands, you know, what I did for so many years and why it was so hard and why I'm so proud about it. And that to me is victory.
Yeah, you know, I kind of felt the same when I read Mackenzie Bezos' review of your book, and I felt that it was very well written. She brought it up with some good points, but at the end of the day, there wasn't just a lot that she could accuse you of that, you know, made any difference. But what I feel also, you know, you say, you know, maybe they don't want the company to be exposed as something that's not warm and cuddly and cozy and the thing that we all love. But, you know, we'll still love Amazon.com, and to a certain degree, you know, you see the heads of these companies, they're like this. And I think it's why we're interested in them and we want to know more. You know, this whole, you know, recent book that has just come out again about Lance Armstrong called Wheelman. You know, again, we're just so fascinated to look into these iconic characters.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, it was something that I kind of wanted to make sure it came through in the book that, you know, despite the little tortured bits of business history, that it is great service. I mean, I'm an Amazon customer. I'm an Amazon Prime member. I own a couple of Kindles. I think you know, I don't have any extreme value judgments to make about the company, you know, in terms of instructing people to shop elsewhere.
Yeah.
I think we all need to have a kind of broader recognition that, you know, our dollars are meaningful, and that if we want, you know, the local commerce around us, particularly the bookstores, to stick around, we need to support them. But, you know, I don't think that the company is in any ways evil. I think he's built a great service, and that it's what makes him so interesting. And to me, when I set out to do this, it was a kind of omission, a collective omission in technology journalism, that no one had profiled him in this way, and that there wasn't a lot of understanding of the company and its culture.
Brad, tell us about the written narrative and if it's actually been effective. It's a unique style of management.
Right. So there are a lot of idiosyncratic customs at Amazon, you know, which is based in Seattle, and one of them is they start all of their meetings with 6-page documents, which they call narratives. And this started about 10 years ago when Bezos decided that he was a little tired of PowerPoint presentations or, you know, someone starting a meeting just talking. You know, he felt like it concealed lazy thinking. It wasn't a very good use of his time. And so he said that meetings need to start with these written documents prepared by whoever was, you know, organizing the meeting or presenting a project. And nobody thought that would stick, and everybody felt like they had been hurled back into eighth grade English. But it, you know, it's really tuned to the way he prefers to process information. He's a big reader, reads newspapers and makes books, and we see that, of course, with the purchase of the Washington Post and the Kindle business. And I'm not sure this would work at any other company. I think some former Amazon folks have tried it and failed as they've moved on elsewhere. But Amazon's very tailored to how Jeff thinks. And so that's one of the strange things about working in Amazon is that you're constantly preparing and reading these narratives.
And has it been effective?
I think it undoubtedly has. Of course, you look at the success of the company, it kind of speaks for itself. It's an open question whether, you know, when the day comes when Jeff moves on, you know, whether it's so particular to how he prefers to run things and his disciples that it would continue to be effective. But for now, I don't think you can argue with it.
Well, Brad, we've really enjoyed this conversation. We've been speaking with Brad Stone, who's written The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. Best of luck, continued success with this book, and what's your next project?
Well, to go back to my day job at Bloomberg Business, we cover in technology, and to look for a story as inspiring to me as the Amazon story.
Okay, Brad, thanks so much.
Thanks Brad.
Guys, I enjoyed it.
All right.
You are listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
This is Larry Warren, General Manager of KPCW. Friday, November 8th, Summit County will help support local nonprofit organizations through the Live PC, Give PC Day of Giving. KPCW supports all local nonprofits through our Open Door policy, annually providing nearly $500,000 in free public service announcements and inviting nonprofits on for interviews. Please consider supporting all local nonprofits by donating to KPCW. Find KPCW on livepcgivepc.org/KPCW.
350 Main is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine Friday through Sunday at 5:30 p.m. We are also serving Sunday brunch starting at 9:30 a.m. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Our second guest this morning is Professor Mike Dunn, Director of Laser Fusion Energy at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. Now, scientists have been working to achieve self-sustaining nuclear fusion and energy gain in the lab for more than a half a century. Ignition experiments at the National Ignition Facility in Livermore are now bringing that long-sought goal much closer to realization. Using 192 giant lasers housed in a 10-story building the size of three football fields, Mike's group will deliver at least 60 times more energy than any previous laser system. His team will focus on more than 1 million joules, measurement of energy, of ultraviolet laser energy on a tiny target in the center of its target chamber, creating conditions similar to those that exist only in the cores of stars and giant planets and inside a nuclear weapon. Wow, this is getting really crazy here. We better go ahead and introduce our next guest, Mike Dunn. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Good morning.
Good morning. So, part of this conversation is bringing up a concept in the past that everyone thought was dead. And so I'd like to start by talking about cold fusion, a little bit of history, where it went, and then we'll get into the conversation about where it is today and how it kind of applies to what you're doing. So, you know, cold fusion.
Sure, yeah. So, fusion, just to take one step back, You know, fusion is the joining together of matter at the very smallest scale, at the scale of the atomic nucleus. So in the center of the sun, you know, the sun joins together hydrogen to form helium, and then helium onwards upwards, you know, through lithium all the way to iron. And to do that, you know, the nucleus of an atom is positively charged. And so two positive charges, if you try to force them together, they repel each other. They really don't like each other, don't want to bond together. And so you've got to force them together. And the sun does this by creating really high temperatures, really high pressures and densities through gravity. And so when people started talking about cold fusion, everybody was very perplexed, you know, because all of the physics we know says you need very high temperatures, very high pressures to force matter together to overcome that mutual repulsion. And so it turned out that the wild speculation that was coming out of some quarters about achieving fusion at very cold temperatures turned out, as far as we can tell today, simply not to be the case. It was a bit of a curiosity of a measurement, but not, as far as we can tell, true fusion.
Right. So this was in part, it took place in 1989, in part at the University of Utah, right here, Fleischmann and Pons.
It did indeed. And it's sort of a story of how science works. You know, people come up with theories, you know, such as you need high temperatures for fusion to happen. And the job of a scientist basically is to try to either prove or disprove those theories. And Fleischmann and Pons went away and saw something very strange in the lab. They seemed to be getting signatures of fusion from very small and very low temperature devices. And you know, they rightly talked to the world about this and said, you know, we're not sure what's going on. We think it might be fusion. So everybody around the world tried to replicate that. Mm. And it turned out that nobody could really replicate exactly what was going on there. And so those initial dreams or hopes or thoughts that it might be fusion turned out not to be the case. But it has actually driven a lot of very interesting science investigation, a lot of condensed matter studies that have gone on. So, you know, all is not lost. You know, it is the story of science. You know, you put forward a speculation, it's disproved, and you move on and you learn something.
But in this case, a lot of people started calling it junk science and they accused Fleischmann of incompetence and fraud. So, I mean, the whole thing got kind of nasty. Has the controversy back in 89 held back your ability to get interest, funding, support?
Well, you know, our funding comes directly from the U.S. government through the Department of Energy. And, you know, there is, you know, rigorous peer review in terms of exactly what gets done and what gets proposed, what gets prioritized. So I think in that case, no. But there is a wider issue that whenever people talk about using fusion for energy production, as we are today, you know, using it as a net source of power, you know, because of all of the positive attributes of fusion, you know, it's clean, it's environmentally sustainable, you know, there's no geological waste, it's inherent, you know, safe and so forth, then it does get complicated by the fact there are many possible routes to fusion, including some that, you know, have been disproved but are still, you know, capture the imagination of the public and others. And so in that sense it does. And so you have to go through a relatively deliberate process of working through, you know, what has been proven, what hasn't been proven, what works and what doesn't work. But ultimately, everything comes down to experiment. What can you demonstrate? And that's why the National Ignition Facility exists, you know, to hopefully finally demonstrate after 50 years or so that fusion can indeed be harnessed here on Earth and is not just the regime of what happens inside the sun or the stars.
So the gist of what you're trying to do is to generate more energy than is used to create the actual implosion.
Exactly.
The fact that you're just and the fact that you're using lasers, I mean, it's any energy source. I believe in France they're using some sort of magnetic fusion.
They are
energy.
Indeed. There are many possible ways of getting there. And, you know, over the past few years, you know, decades even, you know, the world has really settled on two major ways of getting there. You know, there may be others, but most of the interests of the academic community, of the industrial community, is centered on two big projects. One, as you say, in the south of France, where the U.S. and many other countries around the world are joining together to build a big project called ITER. And that uses large magnetic fields to hold together a ball of hot gas. It's shaped a little bit like a donut. Heat that gas up with the intent of getting more energy out than you put in. Now, that project is still just being built. The construction is just starting now, and it will be a few years before it turns on. And over here in the state, Northern California, there's been a facility that was constructed through the 1990s and 2000s. It turned online in 2009, which is a full-scale device, in this case using lasers, very high-power lasers, to try to get to the same conditions. And it's really, how can you deliver energy in an instant of time, you know, in a trillionth of a second, in order to replicate in miniature what goes on at the center of the sun?
Correct me if I'm wrong, with the magnetic fusion energy, are they talking about that being nearly self-sustaining versus the laser-imploded pellet that you think will be self-sustaining?
Well, the two have the same overall objective of getting more energy out than in, a net source of energy, a net source of power, but they operate in two very different modes. You know, magnetic fusion, think of it more like a furnace, if you like, where the fuel sits inside a large container and is constantly burning. You know, a little bit like burning a wood fire or a coal fire, but you're burning fusion material, hydrogen. Whereas laser fusion operates much more like your car engine. You have a tiny amount of fuel at any point in time, and a piston compresses the fuel, ignites, you exhaust and repeat the cycle. But in our case, a piston isn't the mechanical piston that you would find inside your car engine. It's a laser. And the fuel isn't gasoline. It's, again, hydrogen-like fuel. But the piston effectively compresses the fuel, and the idea of the NIF facility is to see, can we compress it so much that the fuel itself ignites, burns in a fusion sense, and gives off lots of energy.
Mm. It's interesting how the way that you're describing it here makes it sound really simple, yet it is a concept that I think is very difficult to grasp for those of us who aren't immersed in science.
Indeed. I mean, the truth is that the concepts are actually quite simple. It's mm-hmm. The detailed implementation turns out to be really hard. I mean, the concept goes all the way back to 1960. The laser was first demonstrated in Malibu, California, it turns out, in May of 1960. And it was just a few days after that that a scientist, actually here at this lab, a guy called John Knuckles, said, well, if you can make a laser work, you know, and the laser just compresses energy into a short burst of time, then you could create the kind of conditions you would find at the center of the sun. So he very quickly, over the course of a few weeks, drew out how you would build a fusion energy-producing scheme. But it's taken 50 or more than 50 years, really, for the technology and the detailed implementation to capture. So, you know, the concept is simple, but the scale of the device, as you say, you know, the size of a football stadium, you know, means that the technology has had to catch up. It's taken many, many years for the technology to catch up. But we believe we are now there in terms of the scale of the laser that's needed, in terms of the optic technology and the making of these tiny little pellets of fuel to such precision that based on the evidence we have so far, the experiments over the past 2 or 3 years, we're not there yet, but we believe it is within the grasp of this facility now to finally get to the point of net energy production, more energy out than in, which is an amazing, you know, culmination of over 50 years of work.
Absolutely. Our guest is Professor Mike Dunn. He's the director of laser fusion energy at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And Mike, I'm wondering if you Google, you know, current research on cold fusion, it's really interesting what comes up. And, you know, it seems like there are a lot of small labs that are also, you know, trying to figure out some sort of fusion. I found this small Minnesota company, Hunt Utilities Group, and you know, they were doing it in their garage sort of thing, or their, you know, home laboratory.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you know, maybe kind of give us an overview of everything that's going on.
Indeed, you know, this whole world of fusion basically splits into two main types of work. You know, it is a very compelling area to work in. You know, we see, you know, many, many students and members of the public, environmental groups, you know, really latching onto this as their future energy source, you know, because it is incredibly compelling from an environmental and safety and, you know, resource sustainability point of view. And so everybody wants to have a go, and which is great. And so, you know, the two characteristics work really are these really big projects where the world gets together or the nation gets together and works on the large laser system here at our lab, or worked on the big magnetic fusion system over in France, But that's informed by universities around the world, you know, down in Utah where you are, you know, across the states, across the world, working on the underlying technology or the underlying physics and science of how fusion works. And some of those people also try to look at, you know, can you make fusion in miniature in a small-scale lab in your garage, mm-hmm. as you say. And it turns out you can. It's relatively easy to make fusion work at small scale, you know, getting hydrogen to combine together into helium. In fact, there's a, you know, a well-told story of, you know, schoolboys doing this at, you know, in their garages, you know, home science project. But it's a big leap, it turns out, to get from just producing a little bit of fusion, you know, a little bit of energy out, all the way through to producing more energy out than you put in. That break-even process, that threshold process of getting more energy out than in, turns out to be really challenging. And that's why it's taken, you know, decades and decades, we think, to finally get to the point where it's now achievable at this scale. But it, the very nature of the process says that it has to be quite large scale in order to get break-even, even though you can get small amounts of energy out at a much smaller scale.
Uh-huh.
So the current status is you've been able to create a tiny spark of fusion ignition. Is that correct?
Indeed. And, you know, the last, you know, the most recent shot produced an enormous number of fusion interactions. You know, and the numbers are mind-boggling. You know, more than 10 to the power 15 fusion reactions. So that's, you know, a thousand million reactions or more per event. You know, a mind-boggling number, but still less than the amount of energy that you have to put in to create it, to make it happen in the first place. So that still remains a challenge, even though mm-hmm. we do believe we're on the, we have a facility that is capable of finally getting there.
And I read a paper somewhere where you said that creating the tiny spark of fusion is one thing, but trying to get it from mixing with everything else so that you can go to the next step, that's a huge challenge.
That's exactly it. And that really is the step we've just been discussing. You know, how do you go from just initiating the event to making it really burn? And think of it just like, you know, a Girl Scout or, you know, Boy Scout trying to create a campfire for the first time. You know, yeah. It's relatively easy to strike a match and get a little bit of kindling or wood to light. And it's another thing to really create a big campfire that really takes hold. And what's really been going on so far is the lasers have been focusing down, you know, creating an initial spark which produces a burst of energy. But the big sticks and logs that surround that fuel haven't really caught. The fire has flared and died off very quickly. And so the challenge is, can we assemble the fusion fuel, you know, just like the logs of a campfire, around that initial spark in such a way that the fire catches?
And back to cold fusion, one of the original objectives, I believe, was that in creating this nuclear fusion, that it occurs at close to room temperature. Is that still an objective?
Well, I mean, that was the hope of cold fusion. But, you know, in all honesty, even though there is some really interesting condensed matter physics, some interesting basic science, as far as the world can tell at the moment, from all the physics that we know, you still do need very high temperatures to get fusion to happen. Now, you know, scientists have been surprised, you know, many, many, many times in the past, you know, in many different spheres of knowledge. But as far as we can tell at the moment, the only credible pathway to large-scale fusion is to make something hot. And we're talking about millions of degrees here. And the two principal ways of getting matter really hot, if you don't have the luxury of gravity like the sun does, you know, the two ways we know of are using very, very high-power lasers or using very strong magnetic fields to hold matter together for long enough to heat it up to these high temperatures.
Mike, I'm wondering which of these two large areas, the lasers or the magnetic field, are, moving along more quickly or showing the most promise?
Well, you know, quickly doesn't really go along with fusion.
Okay,
you know?
That's what I'm getting.
this has been a multi-decade struggle to get from those initial, you know, seemingly simple concepts through to demonstration. But it is an interesting time we are at now. You know, in both cases, the magnetic fusion case and the laser fusion case, there are big, you know, full-scale facilities now being built, or in the case of the laser, has been built to get finally to that, the culmination of all of that work. Now, Mother Nature may still have a trick up her sleeve, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, and she does tend to be a bit tricky every now and again in terms of harnessing fusion. But from the best knowledge that we have, that there is high confidence that both of those pathways will get there. Exactly when is impossible to predict, but...
Yeah. Also, you know, now, I mean, it's been going on for five decades, this research, but, you know, we didn't know then what we know now. We didn't have the technology then that we have now and all that. So I'm sure the acceleration will take place.
And, you know, you see that from the data coming out now. You know, the first year or two of the work here at the National Ignition Facility, you know, produced some great results, but it's only been very recently over the past few months even, past few weeks, few months, that the performance of the machine, the performance of the fusion has really skyrocketed. You know, it's going upwards incredibly quickly at the moment.
Yeah.
So people are getting, you know, incredibly excited. You know, there's still a lot of work to be done, and I'm sure many, many, you know, months ahead of us, or maybe years, who knows. But the rate of progress, as you say, just accelerates and accelerates, such that the level of confidence is very high at the moment.
So we've spoken about the Department of Defense, and we're putting a lot of money into it. And Lawrence
Livermore, Department of Energy in this case. Yeah.
Department of Energy. Mm-hmm. And Lawrence Livermore, of course, has a stellar record in development of a number of different types of projects. And we've also spoken about what's happening in the south of France. But we haven't spoken about China. What are they up to?
Yeah, so China, as you can imagine, are investing heavily into this area also. Now, they have a wonderful magnetic fusion project they call EAST, that is just under development now. And they also have invested very heavily into the laser fusion pathway as well. Very large-scale laser facilities, not yet quite at the same scale as the ignition facility, but they've just announced plans to build effectively the sister device to the ignition facility over there in China, as have the scientists in Russia. And indeed, there's also a very large similarly scaled laser facility underway in France. So, you know, the U.S. is not alone in this. We are ahead at the moment. I would say we're ahead by a few years, but, you know, the world is accelerating the same way that we are. So this is not a time to sit back and contemplate the world. This is a time, you know, to continue to race ahead and hopefully to finally get to this demonstration.
So we're having a conversation this morning, a couple of people in Park City with you, Professor Dunn, and everybody knows who you are now, and it's Lawrence Livermore and all that. Is there any secrecy to this? Are you concerned about the Chinese looking at our research, or is it more of a collaborative?
This is a world. It is based on fundamental science and laser technology. So when it comes to the demonstration of fusion, this is something we're very open about. We subject ourselves to international peer review. We have scientists from all around the world working with us here at this lab. But when it comes to implementing this as a fusion energy technology, building power plants, you know, there we are more circumspect. We're working with a wide range of industries across the U.S. to develop and design power plants that would take advantage of this fusion demonstration from the ignition facility. And doing that in a way that hopefully commercially protects their position.
Mm. I have one more question. We're just about out of time, but I can't let you go without asking this. But, you know, when you say clean energy, it makes everyone's ears perk up. There are huge implications for that.
Right.
Is there any, you know, are there any byproducts that aren't, you know, at this point, is it clean? And, you know, are environmentalists truly embracing this? Is there concern?
You know, nothing's ever entirely perfect, is it? I mean,
yeah.
Whether it be, you know, solar power and producing the photovoltaic cells, you know, whether it be windmills or whatever it may be, and fusion is no different. You know, fusion has its own issues, but they pale into insignificance compared to, the type of safety problems you would get from nuclear power, and the type of energy you produce, you know, is consistent with the type of energy you would get from the other very large-scale energy sources like coal or gas or nuclear, and doesn't have, you know, the issues that an intermittent source like wind or solar would have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the bottom line is, you know, the path forward, if we can show fusion to work, will still be a portfolio solution, you know, a joint solution with, you know, solar where we can get solar, wind where we can get wind, tidal where we can get tidal. But in terms of baseload electricity, you know, there's a world of difference between the environmental and safety consequences of gas and coal and nuclear and the consequences of fusion, which are, you know, very small, very containable, but are not zero. You still need to pay attention to how you manage the fuel, how you manage the a large scale industrial plant, which, you know, any large scale plant has its own electrical hazard, laser hazard, that you just have to be careful about.
Exciting stuff. Professor Mike Dunn, we want to thank you so much. You're actually a great spokesperson for this topic. It's been really great to have you on the show, so thank you.
Well, thank you for your interest. Much appreciated.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that, again, was Professor Mike Dunn, the Director of Laser Fusion Energy at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. And want to thank him, as well as our first guest, Brad Stone. He's the author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos, and The Age of Amazon. This is Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back after this word from our underwriters with today's cool story.
The Youth Winter Sport Report, sponsored by the Winter Sports School. Uncompromised academics for dedicated winter athletes. Wintersportsschool.org, 435-649-8760.
I'm Scott Chester with the Park City High School Booster Club. Keep in touch with all things minors with our weekly Minor Nation Report. We'll bring it to you every Monday during morning news with Leslie Thatcher and in the afternoon on the Local View with Randy Barton. Highlights, scores, schedules, all things minors every Monday.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, and Todd Wakefield, attorney at law.
What's that, Timmy? Someone stuck in the kitchen? What are you trying to tell me? Is it ready?
Having friends and family for Thanksgiving dinner?
Join Fun Friday each week for Thanksgiving dinner do's and don'ts.
Brought to you by Wasatch Pub and Squatters Pub and Brewery.
All Seasons Adventures.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort. And Foothill Oriental Rugs.
There'll be gravy.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. You've got a cool story today.
Oh, I do. And it's... Are you afraid of snakes? Well, the scientists think that your pulmonar may be to blame. And the gist of it, Lynn, is that when when primates evolved 60 million years ago, they adopted to living in trees, searching for food at night, sleeping in this canopy during the day. And snakes were creeping around so that if they saw a snake or thought they saw a snake, they immediately went into flight or fright because snakes were one of their deadliest enemies, and somehow this has become genetically coded from our ancestor, the primates, into our memory and in this part of the brain called the pulmonar, where they think there are extra neurons that are providing this terror when we see a snake.
I've never heard of a pulvinar before, John, but I think I'll look it up after the show. But my friend, one of my best friends, is horrified of snakes. I've been in Costa Rica with her. You know who you are, Betsy. And
there are a lot of snakes in Costa Rica.
Oh, man. And she's going to be so happy to know this wasn't her own conjuring, her fear of snakes, because I always tell her she can talk herself out of it. But this is good. It may be genetically predisposed.
We were fishing in Costa Rica, and there was this snake. It was brightly colored, small, and it was swimming around outside the boat. And the captain said that if that snake bit us, we'd be dead by the time we got into shore.
There's reason. Cause for fear
there's
on that one.
There's cause for fear.
We'll be right back after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Tomorrow on Fun Friday, join John and Jan to salute the unsung heroes of Thanksgiving dinner. Also, big open house at KPCW, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m.
That's right. Live PC, give PC. You've been listening to KPCW 91.9 FM Park City. Also want to thank San Francisco Design and Prudential Utah Real Estate.